silence while they investigate what happened. There was a moment of stunned silence as the crowd pondered the implications of his words. Then a woman shouted,
"No way I'm letting those greedy slugs get their mitts on my ship!"
Her defiant outcry touched off a stampede as everyone tried to get inside at once, pushing and shoving one another out of the way in their haste to grab whatever cargo they could and take off before the Hutts swooped in and closed the spaceport down. Theron waited a few seconds until the small crowd had completely disappeared into the spaceport. Confident there wouldn't be any witnesses sticking around to give his description to the Hutts and cause trouble for Republic SIS, he sauntered off in the other direction, whistling an old Mantellian tune. Chapter 5. Marcus Trant had a lot on his mind. As director of Republic Strategic Information Service, that wasn't unusual. He was always juggling the day-to-day operations of the Republic's intelligence arm with the political games necessary for any government agency to stay afloat. Unlike some of the Republic's more traditional institutions, the Jedi or the Galactic Senate, for example, SIS still had to justify its existence at every turn to keep from getting shut down or having its funding slashed by a senator campaigning for re-election on a platform of responsible government spending. Unlike the military, most of what the SIS did was behind the scenes and off the record. Marcus liked to tell his operatives that if they did their job right, nobody would even know what they had done. Unfortunately, that answer didn't fly when facing a budget hearing. The bureaucrats who ultimately decided his organization's fate wanted something to show for the credits they poured into the SIS. They expected the director to reveal highly classified mission details, ignoring the fact that doing so would jeopardize his people. Fending off their ridiculous request was exhausting. Things would be much easier with a strong political ally who could vouch for the value of what the SIS did. Someone too powerful and important to be questioned by the politicians and desk jockeys. Someone like Jace Malcolm, the supreme commander of the Republic military. Jace was a highly respected and universally admired war hero. Having him in the SIS corner would help get the simpering bureaucrats to back off. The recently appointed Supreme Commander had asked SIS to undertake a special mission. Everything had been going smoothly until Theron got mixed up in it. The director hadn't heard from Theron since yesterday, when he'd tersely broken off their conversation about what he was doing on Nar Shaddaa. Since then, Theron had disappeared, but not before disabling a fellow SIS agent, causing an industrial accident at one of Nar Shaddaa's spaceports, and unraveling 3 months of covert surveillance. Despite all this, the director was waiting before filing his official report. Theron was one of his best agents. He'd earned the benefit of the doubt. The least Marcus could do was wait to hear his side of the story before ending his career. The receptionist behind the desk in Jace's waiting room looked up at his arrival, and Marcus was immediately struck by her remarkable green eyes.
"Go right in, Director,"
she said, flashing him a dazzling smile as she pressed the button to open the office door in the wall behind her.
"The Commander's waiting for you."
He passed by the receptionist and into the office beyond, trying to focus on how he could explain what had gone wrong to the Supreme Commander without getting Theron court-martialed. Jace Malcolm was seated behind a desk, studying his computer monitor intently. His skin was lighter than the director's own ebony hue, though still tanned and weathered, the complexion of a man who had spent most of his life outdoors. Hints of his age showed in the crow's feet around his eyes and the slight graying at the temples of his dark hair, though it was hard to notice with the short military cut he sported. But his body was still in fighting shape. Broad-shouldered and thick-chested, he looked like he could hold his own on the battlefield. His most notable feature was the gruesome patchwork of scars and melted flesh that covered most of the right side of his face. He'd been wounded by a detonator many years ago at the Battle of Alderaan, while serving as the leader of the legendary Havoc Squad Special Forces Unit. Looking at the scarring, the director couldn't help thinking of Theron again. It had been Theron's mother, Master Satil Shan, now the Grand Master of the Jedi Order, who led the Jedi that fought alongside Havoc Squad that day. Together, Satele and Jace fought the Sith Lord Darth Malgus on the battlefield, turning the tide of the conflict. Though Malgus survived the encounter, the Republic won the day and reclaimed Alderaan from the Empire.
"Close the door, Director," Jace said, turning away from the screen. "And take a seat."
Marcus snapped off a curt salute, then settled into the chair across from the Supreme Commander.
"Your message said we had to talk about Transom," Jace said. "I assume something's gone wrong?"
"Someone slipped in and freed the prisoners before the auction," the Director explained. "Stole them right out from under Morbo's nose."
"And blew up a spaceport, too,"
Jace noted.
"And that," Marcus admitted sheepishly. "Transom is Jace's pet project. Should have guessed he'd be following it more closely than usual."
"I thought the plan was to wait until after the auction," Jace pressed. "Get our people back after they left Nar Shaddaa, so Morbo wouldn't know we'd found out about his slave trafficking ring."
"We had a communication breakdown," Marcus said, choosing his words carefully. "Two agents following different agendas got in each other's way. We're still trying to sort out the details."
"Isn't it your job to make sure your agents stay out of each other's way?"
the Supreme Commander asked. The Director's options were clear. Tell Jace about Theron defying orders to act on his own, or stay silent and take the blame himself.
"You're right, sir. I accept full responsibility. It won't happen again."
The Supreme Commander didn't reply. Instead, he just stared at Marcus in silence, causing the Director to shift uncomfortably in his seat.
"He knows I'm holding something back, covering for someone."
Eager to get out from under Jace's penetrating gaze, the Director broke the silence.
"I know how important Operation Transom was to you, sir," Marcus said. "And we did manage to rescue Republic soldiers who would otherwise have spent their lives as slaves. Maybe what happened on Nar Shaddaa will send a message," he continued. "Make the Hutts think twice before selling off Republic POWs. Remind them that we look after our own."
"Let's hope so,"
Jace said, his glare softening.
"Maybe it's for the best, anyway. Free up resources for something else. Something big."
"Something bigger than saving your fellow soldiers from slavery?"
Marcus silently wondered.
"What are your feelings on the current state of the war effort?"
the Supreme Commander asked, seeming to suddenly change topics. The question was familiar enough. The Director had answered it 100 different times in various meetings over the years. Usually, he would give the answer he thought the listener was looking for to make the meeting go more smoothly. But Jace wasn't like the politicians he usually dealt with, and he decided that being blunt and honest was worth the risk.
"The Empire is reeling. For the first time in decades, we have the upper hand. When the Emperor fell, it left a void atop the Sith power structure. Malgus tried to fill it, but when his coup failed and he was killed, the Empire was left without a clear leader to rally them."
After a brief pause, he added,
"Imperial intelligence has fallen apart. Without their input, the Imperial military strategy has become ineffective and unfocused. You can't run a war without good intel."
"You don't have to sell me on SIS,
Jace told him, a hint of a smile on his lips.
"I appreciate what you bring to the table. Believe it or not, I actually read all those reports you send me."
"Sorry, Commander. I guess I'm used to dealing with politicians and bureaucrats."
"I've been studying your analysis of Imperial threats quite closely,"
Jace continued.
"There's one in particular that caught my eye. The Ascendant Spear."
Once again, Marcus's thoughts returned to Theron. The Ascendant Spear was a prototype long-range battlecruiser developed by the brilliant Darth Mekkis as part of a secret Imperial weapons program. Theron, with the help of his mentor, Jedi Master Nagani Jo, learned about the program and nearly ended it by killing Darth Mekkis. Of all her deadly creations, only the Ascendant Spear still survived.
"Jo died on that mission,"
Marcus thought.
gave his life to save Tefith. That's why Theron feels responsible for her now.
All the connections to Theron were starting to feel like more than just coincidence. His mother would probably say something about the Force working in mysterious ways. But the director knew Theron wasn't attuned to the Force. Not like a Jedi.
Something wrong, Director?
Marcus shook his head, trying to get out of his own thoughts.
Just thinking about the Ascendant Spear.
Fill me in.
Most of what we know is theory and conjecture, pieced together from battlefield reports. It's got some kind of revolutionary hyperdrive. Probably the fastest ship ever built. Enough firepower to wipe out an entire fleet.
Your reports estimate the Ascendant Spear is responsible for more Republic casualties than the next 10 most effective Imperial battlecruisers combined.
The Spear is so much more advanced than any other ship that we still don't know its full capabilities,
the Director admitted.
And what about the Commander? Darth Carrot?
Darth Malgus's apprentice, the Director said. She's a Faline. Used to be on our side. Trained with the Jedi before defecting to the Sith.
I'm surprised they accepted her, Jace said. I thought they believed only humans and pure-blooded Sith were worthy of joining their ranks.
Malgus was different, Marcus explained, before adding, Carrad's a tactical genius, and she's completely ruthless. Every battle the Ascendant Spear has been involved in has been a massacre for our side. If it weren't for Carrad and the Spear, we might have already won this war.
Jace nodded, and the Director had the impression that the Supreme Commander already knew all this. It was almost as if Jace had been testing him.
I'm putting a task force together to take Ascendant Spear down, the Supreme Commander said.
Marcus was impressed by the boldness of the plan, but his enthusiasm was tempered by reality. As much as he wanted to voice his support to get in good with Jace, he felt he owed it to the Supreme Commander to be honest.
SIS has investigated this option before, Marcus said. We couldn't find a way to make it work.
This isn't going to be an SIS op,
Jace told him.
I want a joint mission, with the full cooperation of the military, the Jedi, and SIS.
SIS is at your disposal,
the Director assured him, though inside he was skeptical. Joint missions were great in theory, but in practice they tended to become turf wars, as the different agencies fought to take all the credit and shift all the blame.
I know what you're thinking, Jace said, but this is too big for anyone to handle alone. The only way to pull this off is to work together.
The Supreme Commander stood and came around from behind the desk, moving quickly. He seized Marcus's shoulders with his massive hands, his steel grip just short of being painful. Leaning forward, he brought his face in close. His unblinking eyes seemed to bore deep into the Director, as if Jace was seeking out the depths of his heart and mind.
"Don't tell me what I want to hear,"
he insisted.
"I believe we can do this. And I need you to believe it, too. Are you with me, Marcus? Really, truly with me?"
"I'm with you, Commander," the Director vowed,
his reservations swept away by the Supreme Commander's raw intensity and conviction.
"Good man,"
Jace said, patting him on the shoulders as he released his grip and stood up.
"I knew I could count on you."
He made his way back around to the other side of the desk and settled back into his chair.
"I'm sending you everything I have on the Spear and Darth Carrad,"
Jace told him.
"Classified reports from every military engagement the Spear's been involved in. Confidential evaluations prepared by Carrad's trainers and the masters at the Jedi Academy. Everything. Study it all in detail and send me a list of agents you'd recommend for this job. I want those dossiers by next week."
"Yes, sir,"
Marcus said.
"Remember, this is our top priority,"
Jace said.
"The Ascendant Spear is the single biggest threat to the Republic, our fleets, and our citizens. I intend to destroy it, and I want you to tell me how.
Chapter 6.
This is an outrage!
Darth Ravage exclaimed.
Malgus was a traitor who tried to usurp the Emperor's throne. Now you expect us to grant his apprentice a seat on the Dark Council?
Darth Marr, senior ranking member of the Dark Council, refused to respond in kind to Ravage's aggressive outburst. Instead, he carefully gauged the reactions of the six other members who had gathered in the meeting chamber deep inside the Emperor's citadel on Dromund Kaas. Unlike Ravage, they remained calm, though from their expressions it was clear they shared his reservations.
No one of us can make demands on the others, Marr assured them. But I will remind you that Darth Carid turned her back on Malgus when he turned his back on us. And Darth Hadra's untimely demise has left the sphere of technology vacant. All I'm asking is that you consider her as a candidate for the position.
She's a Faulleen,
Darth Mortis objected. Darth Rictus, the oldest member of the council, nodded to show he shared Mortis's opinion. Marr fought back the urge to rail against their bigotry. Malgus had overreached when he tried to proclaim himself the new emperor, but he was right about one thing. If the Empire wanted to defeat the Republic, they could no longer cling to their overt prejudice against lesser species. Keeping entire worlds subjugated put too great a strain on Imperial military resources. It was far more efficient to try and enlist them as willing allies in the war against the Republic. But Marr knew arguments would only push the already fragile Dark Council toward a complete schism. Now was not the time for infighting. The Republic had them in retreat across the galaxy. A united front was their only hope of survival. Defense of the Empire was his official sphere of influence, so it fell to him to bridge the divides among his fellow council members.
Our numbers dwindle, Marr reminded them. We need allies. Elevating a Faulleen to the Council shows other species that there is a place for them in our Empire.
Perhaps the problem is that the other species have forgotten their proper place,
Mortis replied.
Well played, Mortis,
Darth Balron chimed in, letting his words hang in the air for a dramatic moment, before adding,
Yet we should not dismiss Darth Carid so quickly.
Marr had been hoping for Valron's support. A pure-blooded Sith who reveled in the courtly intrigue, sly politics, and unbridled hedonism of the Imperial nobility, he was also responsible for the production and logistics sphere of influence. He knew numbers better than anyone. The Republic had more soldiers, more resources, and more allies than the Empire. And if the Empire couldn't recruit more worlds to its side, it was going to lose.
Darth Carid has proven herself quite valuable to our war effort,
Valron reminded them all.
Without her, our situation would be untenable rather than just precarious.
Darth Ravage grunted, unconvinced.
You're giving the credit to her, when we all know it should really go to the ship. Any one of us could have her success if we controlled the Ascendant Spear.
And therein lies the problem,
Balron continued.
We don't control it. She does. And I doubt she'll hand it over to you just because you ask.
The ship is part of the equation, Marr admitted. Darth Mekkis controlled the technology sphere when she developed the Ascendant Spear. There is some logic in giving the portfolio to the one who now controls the last of her creations.
Are you scared of her?
Darth Rictus asked, ending his question with a gleeful cackle. Marr ignored the question, refusing to rise to the old man's bait.
I'm willing to consider other candidates for the seat, he continued. If any of you has a worthy suggestion.
Darth Grievous,
Mortis offered, and there was a general murmur of assent from the rest of the group. Inwardly, Marr cringed. It wasn't that Grievous wasn't suitable for the position. The Dark Lord had proven his worth by successfully undermining the Republic campaign to restore the devastated world of Taris. But Bravis was a link to the old ways. Ambitious and ruthless, he had earned many influential allies in the upper echelons of Imperial society, and just as many enemies. Bringing him into the Council would open the door for more infighting, as old grudges would be rekindled, and it would do nothing to convince other species to join the Imperial cause. Worst of all, his selection was sure to anger Darth Carid. Fortunately, Gravis's victory on Terrace had been overshadowed when his fleets lost control of the mineral-rich world of Lerator, a costly setback for the Empire.
Gravis failed to keep the Republic at bay in the Mid-Rim, he reminded them.
He has fallen back to Bothawee to regroup,
Mortis replied.
Soon he will launch a counteroffensive and reclaim Lerator for the Empire.
If he is successful, then I can see no reason to oppose him as a candidate,
Mar grudgingly admitted.
Then we are all in agreement, Mortis pushed. Once Lerator is back under Imperial control, Gravis should be given a seat on the Dark Council and control over the technology sphere.
Mar spoke quickly before anyone else could interject.
I said I wouldn't oppose Gravis as a candidate,
he said, his voice firm.
He should be considered, as should Carid. We should take some time to think about both candidates before we make a final decision.
Once again, we are all humbled by your wisdom, Darth Mar,
Valron said, his voice hovering on the line between sincerity and mockery.
I propose we adjourn this meeting so we can all ponder this very important decision.
As the members of the Dark Council left the room, Mar could only imagine how Darth Carid would react when she heard the news. He decided it would be best if he told her himself. It took less than 20 minutes for Mar's private shuttle to whisk him away from the Citadel to the private landing pad at his personal stronghold on the outskirts of Koth City. An honor guard of half a dozen Imperial soldiers in full armor stood smartly at attention as he strode down the boarding ramp, and a pair of bowing servants dressed in his personal colors opened the massive doors leading from the landing pad to the interior chambers. Part domicile, part fortress, the stronghold's halls were busy with household staff and military personnel scurrying to and fro, each tending to their respective duties. They bowed or saluted appropriately as Mar passed, his long strides taking him directly to the communications room.
Put me in contact with Darth Carid,
he told the officer in charge.
At once, my lord,
she told him, then barked out a quick series of orders to her three-person staff. Mar would have preferred to deliver the details of the Dark Council's meeting to Carid in person, but time was of the essence. He wanted to speak with her before she heard the whispers and rumors of what had happened, so he could mitigate her reaction.
The Ascendant Spear has received our signal, Darth Mar,
the officer confirmed.
Decryption may take a few seconds.
Mar nodded, knowing there was no possible way any of the other members of the Council or anyone from the Republic could overhear what was about to be said. Even if they somehow intercepted the signal he was transmitting, it would be impossible to decode without a black cipher, the Empire's encryption device. Developed by Imperial Intelligence before the organization collapsed, the black ciphers were the most advanced encryption machines ever devised. Apart from the ones installed on the Empire's 15 largest capital ships, including the Ascendant Spear, there were only two others. One in the office of the Imperial Minister of Logistics, and one in Darth Mar's possession. The hollow image flickered and materialized before him as the cipher unscrambled the incoming return signal to reveal Darth Carid. Her bright emerald skin and long black hair, some gathered in a topknot, some flowing down her back, were muted by the blue-tinged hollow signal. She had high, prominent cheekbones, a flawless complexion, and a sharp, well-proportioned nose and chin. But there was a vaguely disconcerting reptilian hint to her exotic features, particularly around her cold, dead eyes. And in Carid's case, the exquisite symmetrical perfection so common to her species was marred by the prominent tattoos and cybernetic implants that completely covered the left side of her face.
Darth Mar, I was expecting your call.
From the hollow, Mar recognized that she had relayed his incoming signal to the seclusion of her private command pod deep inside the Ascendant Spear. The complex network of biomechanical interfaces that allowed Kerid to become one with Darth Mekkis' marvelous warship framed her image. Dozens of long, thin wires snaking out from the walls and ceiling and into the back of Kerid's neck and skull.
"Leave us,"
Mar commanded, and the communications officer and her staff vanished from the room.
"You spoke with the other members of the Dark Council?"
Kerid asked once they were alone.
"The ones that matter,"
Mar said.
"And what was their reaction?"
"They agreed that you are a strong candidate,"
Mar said, choosing his words carefully.
"But there are some who expressed concerns."
"Who?"
Kerid demanded, her face twisting in anger.
"Ravage? That old fool rigged this?"
"It doesn't matter. The Council must reach a consensus to bring in a new member."
"Is it because I am Fallen?"
"There are other concerns. You were Malgus's apprentice for many years. His actions will always color your reputation."
"Malgus was a traitor,"
Kerid spat out, her bright green skin taking on a reddish hue, reflecting her heightened emotional state.
"But I have done more to support the Imperial war effort than anyone."
"Those of us who have dedicated our lives in the service of the Dark Council might disagree,"
Mar replied coldly.
"I meant no disrespect, Darth Mar."
Mar knew her reaction was instinctual. The Fallen had evolved overtly sensual mannerisms as a survival mechanism for the species. Mar was smart enough to recognize and dismiss the subtle feelings of arousal her voice triggered in him. But individuals of most humanoid species found it hard to resist the Fallen charms.
"I have proven my loyalty to the Empire countless times. I did not think the Council would simply cast me aside."
"You have not been cast aside. You are still a candidate, but there are others."
"Who?"
Mar hesitated, then decided she would eventually find out anyway.
"Darth Gravis."
"Gravis? So Mortis is behind this. He and Gravis are thick as thieves."
"Mortis supports Gravis, but so do many other members of the Council. His work on Terra shows that he would do well in charge of the technology sphere."
"The Empire claims to be a meritocracy. We punish failure and reward success. I have only victories to my name. But Gravis lost Lerator to the Republic. How can the Council prefer him over me?"
"Gravis is planning to recapture Lerator. But even if he succeeds, the decision is not final,"
he added, hoping to mollify her.
"You will both be considered for the position."
"So there is still a chance,"
Kerid replied, seizing on the thin strand of hope. She brought a delicate hand up to her lips as she contemplated the possibility of victory.
"Assuming he can defeat the Republic fleet over Lerator, most of the Council will probably support Gravis,"
Mar cautioned, not wanting her to get her hopes too high, only to have them dashed.
"And what about you, Mar?"
"I would prefer the position go to you. In the long run, you can be of more value to the Empire than Gravis. But I will not risk tearing the Dark Council apart by challenging the others if they back him."
"So you will not fight for me?"
"We must choose our battles wisely. Sometimes it is better to be patient."
"I have been patient,"
she answered, her expression a sensual pout.
"There are other seats on the Council, other spheres of influence that need to be filled. Gravis may be the leading candidate, but you are next in line."
There was a long pause before Kerid nodded her acceptance.
"I understand, Darth Mar. Even though we are allies, I cannot expect you to fight this battle on my behalf."
Mar felt a great sense of relief, though he was careful not to show his reaction. Part of him had feared Kerid might react with blind rage at being passed over. If she turned against the Empire, The Ascendant Spear would cripple the Imperial fleet, paving the way for a quick and certain Republic victory in the war.
Your time will come,
Mar assured her.
It is inevitable.
At least we agree on something,
she said with a smile. Chapter 7. Theron punched the comlink of his small shuttle, opening a hailing frequency with the control tower at one of the hundreds of spaceports on Coruscant's surface.
This is Sojourner requesting landing clearance.
Copy that, Sojourner. Transmit ship registration for authentication.
Transmitting.
There was a longer pause than usual on the other end of the comlink before the voice replied,
Sojourner, you need to reroute to another spaceport. Sending coordinates now.
Theron didn't bother to protest. He knew what was going on.
Guess I should have called the director after that mess on Nar Shaddaa. Understood,
he said, not bothering to look at the new coordinates. He already knew exactly where they would order him to go.
A security escort is awaiting your arrival.
I bet they are,
he answered, disconnecting the call. As he brought the ship into land, Theron noticed two men wearing Coruscant Security Force uniforms standing by a waiting speeder. He doubted they were actually part of the official planet-wide security force. The director wouldn't involve a civilian organization unless he had to, and it was common for SIS personnel to adopt the uniforms of local authorities when they were expecting trouble, but wanted to avoid drawing extra attention.
Theron Shan?
One of the men said as he climbed out of his shuttle.
What if I say no?
Don't cause any trouble, the other warned. The director's not in the mood.
Theron briefly thought about making a move. It wasn't that he was actually worried about what the director had planned, but he was eager to test himself against the two agents sent to bring him in. But in the end, he realized he was being foolish. The agents were just following orders. No need to hurt somebody.
We're all on the same side here,
he assured them. The ride to SIS headquarters was conducted in complete silence. Theron's escorts appeared calm and relaxed, but he could tell they were watching him closely the entire way. Upon landing, they led him into the building, one marching in front of him, the other behind. They didn't break formation until they reached the director's office. One of the men reached out and pressed the buzzer on the door. In response, it slid open, and the director called out,
I'll take it from here.
Theron gave each of his guards a cheery wave and stepped into the room. As the door slid shut behind him, the director looked up from behind his desk and shook his head.
Can't tell me why I shouldn't have you court-martialed for physically assaulting a fellow agent?
That hook came at me first,
Theron reminded him.
I was just minding my own business on Nar Shaddaa when he pressed that knife up against my back. How was I supposed to know he was one of ours?
A review board might buy that,
the director admitted.
Until they remember the part where I ordered you to get off Nar Shaddaa.
I just thought you were being overprotective,
Theron protested.
I would have taken you a little more seriously if I'd known you were in the middle of a mission, but you didn't really explain the situation.
I don't have to explain things,
the director snapped.
I'm the boss, remember? I give you an order and you follow it!
Theron shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
At least I managed to rescue the prisoners.
But you did it in a way that compromised the entire operation. You think this is the first time Morbo's auctioned off our people? We've been watching him for months, tracking his suppliers and marking his buyers, slowly putting together all the bits and pieces of the entire operation. Operation Transom wasn't about rescuing 4 Cathar. It was about putting an end to the whole POW slave trade.
Come on, Director,
Theron replied, raising an incredulous eyebrow.
We both know that would never happen. Even if you shut down everyone Morbo ever dealt with, someone else would just step in to take his place.
Maybe so,
the Director conceded.
But at least we'd slow them down for a while. Make the traffic dry up.
Morbo and everyone else at that auction thinks the explosion at the spaceport has something to do with selling POWs,
Theron countered.
They're not going to start chasing after fresh meat anytime soon.
I heard there were casualties,
the director said.
Four dead, Theron admitted. Three were hired assassins, kind of asking for it if you go into that line of work. The fourth was a low-level thug working for the old Tien Brotherhood. I looked into him. He won't be missed.
So Tephith made it out okay?
More or less.
Then I guess it's all worth it in your book.
The director sighed.
Did she have any idea you were there?
I don't think so.
With all the times you've helped her out, she can't be that bright if she hasn't noticed you by now.
Theron smiled.
Maybe I'm just that good.
I still think you should let her know that she's in your debt. Might make her more likely to help us out down the road.
That's not how Tephith's mind works,
Theron said, shaking his head.
She's complicated.
The director got up from behind his desk and came around to the other side, crossing his arms as he sat on the edge.
Theron, she's become more trouble than she's worth,
the director told him.
It was bad enough when all you were doing was chewing up your vacation days to help her out. Now it's interfering with ongoing SIS missions. I can't allow that.
I know you think this is just some crazy obsession, Theron told him. But down the road, this is going to pay off. Sooner or later, SIS is going to need her help.
How do you know that? Is that you talking or Nagani Joe? You having visions through the Force now?
The words stung, but Theron wasn't going to back down.
Master Joe used to tell me that what most people call gut instinct is really just the Force reaching out to us. He said we'd be better off if we listened to it more often. And I have a feeling about Tephith.
And I've got a feeling about you, the director said. A bad feeling.
He turned away and went back to sit behind his desk. He took a deep breath and let it out in a long, slow sigh. Then he reached out with his hands and placed them on the top of his desk, fingers spread wide as if bracing himself for what he was about to say.
Theron, I'm transferring you to the analytics department, effective immediately.
Analytics? Theron exclaimed in disbelief. You trying to turn me into some kind of number-crunching desk jockey?
I can't just ignore what happened on Nar Shaddaa,
the director said.
You're a good agent, and I want to keep you in the fold, but you have to learn that your actions have consequences. Besides, he added, it's good to have experience in other departments. I think a 3-month stretch with analytics will make you a more rounded agent.
I'm plenty rounded already, Theron said.
You need a break from field work,
the director insisted.
Since you can't seem to stay out of trouble, even when you're supposed to be on vacation, this is the only option I have left.
I'm not cut out for office work, Theron said. You've seen my personnel profile.
Our evaluations say you're highly intelligent, intuitive, and adaptable. I think you'll fit in just fine.
Theron chewed his lip in angry silence before saying,
What if I resign?
You won't, the director countered. You care too much about the Republic to simply abandon the cause.
I could go work for the military,
he threatened.
Saluting superior officers? Following orders? Barking out, Sir, yes, sir, 20 times a day? Right.
Fine, then, Theron said. I'll just put in for the rest of my vacation time.
Request denied, the director answered. Got a special project in the works, by order of the Republic Supreme Commander. All hands on board.
Nothing personal.
Theron sighed and bowed his head in defeat.
You start tomorrow morning,
the director continued.
Analytics is on the 3rd floor. Do I need to send another escort to make sure you show up?
I'll be there, Theron promised. But I won't be happy about it.
Give analytics a chance,
the director suggested.
They do important work, and we really are working on a special assignment for Jace Malcolm. We're calling it Operation Endgame. Trust me, Theron, he added. You want to be a part of this.
Chapter 8. Seated in the command chair on the bridge of the Ascendant Spear, Darth Carrot struggled to keep her contempt at bay as her gaze traced across the 24 Imperial officers and crew working at their stations all around her. Huddled over consoles and computer screens, their fingers flew over control pads as they reacted to the constant stream of incoming data while the vessel hurled through the empty void of hyperspace. The inefficiency of their clumsy, archaic method of interacting with the ship filled her with disgust.
10 minutes until we reach Lerator, my lord,
Moff Lorman said from his seat on the far side of the bridge.
Be sure to come out of hyperspace beyond the range of the Republic sensors,
she cautioned. It was unlikely Lorman would make such a careless and obvious error. The Moff was a capable officer. But like nearly every Imperial assigned to the Ascendant Spear, he was an interloper on her ship. An insignificant parasite clinging to the underbelly. And she didn't trust him not to make a mistake that would put her ship in danger. Darth Mekkis had designed the vessel with numerous automated systems, and the Spear required a crew of only 3,000 to operate at peak efficiency, less than half of what would typically be assigned to an Imperial capital ship. Carrot had come to accept them as a necessary inconvenience, though there were times, like now, when she resented their presence. When plugged into the Spear's command pod, she had total access to all the vessel's systems and sensors. But the effort of controlling an entire capital ship single-handedly was mentally and physically exhausting. She had no choice but to defer to Moff Lorman and his crew during routine travel and other similarly mundane activities, allowing them to run the vessel using conventional means, while she saved her energies for the high intensity of battle.
When will we send a message to Darth Gravis, telling him reinforcements are on the way, my lord?
Moff Lorman asked. Carrot rose from her seat.
I will contact Gravis, she said, after I have taken command of my ship.
She crossed the bridge with quick, purposeful strides, making her way to the turbo lift. The doors slid open, and she stepped inside, pressing the button that whisked her down past floor after floor until she reached the innermost level of the vessel. She stepped out of the turbo lift and made her way down the short corridor leading to a heavily secured door. A retinal scan confirmed her identity, and the door slid open to reveal the Ascendant Spear's true heart. The circular chamber was nearly 30 meters in diameter, but the inside was empty, save for the control console on the perimeter, Carrot's two apprentices, one a male human, the other a female pure-blooded Sith, and the large crystal sphere in the center. The apprentices were sitting cross-legged on the floor on either side of the sphere, meditating to focus their minds in preparation for the coming battle.
It's time,
Carrot said as she approached the sphere. She placed a hand on the cool exterior, and the sphere parted vertically in the middle, the two halves opening at her touch to reveal the true genius of Darth Mekkis. The interior of the Ascendant Spear's isolated command pod featured a single chair surrounded by dozens of monitors and screens. A delicate web of interwoven wires was suspended a meter above the chair. A dozen loose strands hung down from the web, each tipped with a long, thin needle. Lowering herself into the chair, Carrot's fingers tapped the control panels built into the arms. The pod slowly closed, encasing her in the nearly indestructible glittering cocoon. The fingers of her left hand traced a complex pattern over the control panel, powering up the command pod and causing the web of dangling wires above her head to come to life. Twisting and writhing, they slithered down to wrap themselves around Carrot's face and the back of her skull. Carrot closed her eyes in eager anticipation, allowing the dark side of the Force to flow through her. Outside the sphere, she sensed her apprentices deep in meditation, opening themselves to her so she could draw on their strength as she took command of the spear. The wires gently caressed her neck and cheeks with the fine-tipped needles on the end, sending a shiver down the fallen spine. Then, one of the needles plunged itself into the cybernetic implant at the back of her neck, making her gasp aloud. Another slid into the implant behind her left ear,
and two more burrowed into the left side of her skull, on either side of her temple. Two connected to her forehead, and five more pierced the back of the skull. The final strand of wire slithered across the lid of her still-closed eye before slipping into the tiny aperture of the cybernetic interface implanted in her left cheek. She opened her eyes, her vision now an amalgamation of what she saw on the screens and monitors, as well as everything within range of the ship's sensors. The starfield flickered rapidly into view as the Ascendant Spear dropped from hyperspace on the edge of the Ukrali sector, just beyond sensor range of the Imperial and Republic fleets engaged in battle over the skies of Lerator. Though the other ships couldn't detect her presence at this range, the Spear's advanced systems gave Carrot a perfect awareness of what was transpiring. A combination of her force abilities and the cybernetic implants relaying data from the Ascendant Spear's long-range scanners enabled Carrot to instantly see that although the battle had just begun, Darth Gravis already had the upper hand. The Republic had a single capital ship in the fray, the Martyrus, a D-class attack cruiser. Over 500 meters in length, the Martyrus had a wide, flat hull covered with a thick layer of armor plating, as if the vessel were hidden under a hump-shaped shell. It was supported by two hammerheads half its size, easily identifiable by the forward bridges, extending perpendicularly above and below the longer main body of the vessel, and three slightly smaller CR-12 corvettes, sleek narrow ships equipped with battering ram-shaped bows to run enemy blockades and prominent external afterburners to enhance speed and maneuverability. The fleet was rounded out by half a dozen BT-7 Thunderclap fighters, the latest Republic incarnation in personal attack craft. The agile Thunderclap resembled a sideways Y, with the cockpit situated in the crook of the two smaller arms. In contrast, Gravis's personal dreadnought, Exemplar, was almost 800 meters in length. The wedge-shaped capital ship was flanked by three claw-shaped C-class destroyers that were nearly as large as the Republic flagship. Each destroyer was supported by a complement of six interceptors, the Empire's agile, fang-winged answer to the Republic Thunderclap. Gravis had devised a plan that would minimize the risk to his own ship. The destroyers had been deployed to engage the corvettes and Thunderclap fighters, freeing up the quick and nimble interceptors to continuously strafe the hammerheads and the heavily armored Martyrus. This allowed the Exemplar to remain at safe distance, firing away with its batteries at the Republic vessels with no fear of any return assault. Unfortunately, unless Gravis moved closer to the action, he was limited to inflicting minimal damage on the enemy capital ship's deflector shields and reinforced hull. Ultimately, the Imperials would prevail, but it would be a battle of attrition. Carrot had neither the patience nor the temperament for such a strategy. With a flick of her little finger, she opened a hailing channel to the Exemplar, accelerating the Ascendant Spear toward the other vessels at the same time.
Darth Gravis, this is Darth Carrot. The Ascendant Spear is at your disposal.
Gravis's reply was swift and certain.
Disengage, Carrot. We didn't call for reinforcements. This is my battle to win, not yours.
Carrot ignored his orders. The Ascendant Spear's engines had already accelerated the ship to 70% of maximum sublight speed, bringing them in range of the Republic sensors. The triangular design of the Spear was common among Imperial capital ships, but its immense size, more than twice that of any other participant in the battle, was instantly recognizable. As Carrot had expected, the Spear's arrival drew an immediate response as one of the Republic hammerheads disengaged and came about to face the new threat. Two of the Thunderclap fighters also veered around, spinning and diving to avoid the destroyer cannons as they sped off to support the hammerhead. The hammerhead's turbo lasers opened fire a second later. On a level deep within her subconscious mind, Carrot felt the heat as the Spear's deflectors easily repelled the first volley. An instant later, the Thunderclap swooped in, one from port, the other from starboard. Lacking enough firepower to inflict significant damage on a ship the size of the Ascendant Spear, beyond point-blank range, the pilots relied on speed and maneuverability to get in close enough to strafe the surface of the larger vessel. To Carrot, they were like annoying insects buzzing in her ear. The only logical response was to slap them out of existence. She focused her mind on the starboard defense turrets, using the spear's sensors to track the fast-moving thunderclap before willing the guns to fire. A rapid series of ion blasts hit the fighter in rapid succession, each one striking its target with the unnatural precision made possible only by the perfect fusion of machine and organic. The thunderclap exploded in a ball of heat and light, but Carrot barely noticed. She had her sights set fully on the second fighter. The pilot was taking desperate evasive maneuvers, wheeling, spinning, and diving at crazy angles. Against the augmented reactions derived from Carrot's symbiotic link to her ship, he may as well have been standing still. The port turrets fired, and the second thunderclap disintegrated. The hammerhead opened fire again, and Carrot once more had the sensation of distant heat as the deflectors repelled the incoming blasts. The hammerhead was still too far out to pose any real threat. It had been relying on the fighters to occupy the enemy until it got in close enough to pierce the spear's shields. Bereft of their escort, they were vulnerable and exposed. Carrot seized the opportunity, opening fire with the Ascendant Spear's main guns. The blackness of space was illuminated by a blazing barrage of concentrated red energy beams. They ripped through the Hammerhead's deflector shields and shredded the armor-plated hull. Inside, the emergency systems would be overloaded as the vessel's automated systems tried to somehow keep it functional long enough for the crew to evacuate. A second volley from the spear ended that faint hope as the lasers pierced the engine core containment unit and the Hammerhead vanished in a violent explosion. Gravis's voice rang out once more, simultaneously echoing in Carrot's ears and in the part of her brain that was linked to the ship's communication systems.
You think this will turn the Dark Council against me, Carrot? You could take out every Republic ship in this quadrant, but when it comes time to choose someone to join their ranks, they'll still pick me over a Farlene.
You do not grasp the danger you are in, Gravis. You could be killed in this battle. I am here to ensure a desirable outcome for the Empire.
The threat was veiled, but like any true Sith, her rival immediately understood the sinister implications of her words. Only one of them would leave this battle alive.
Ignore the Republic ships!
Gravis commanded his fleet, forgetting in his panic that the new orders were being transmitted over the same standard Imperial frequency Carrot was using.
Fire on the Ascendant Spear! Destroy it at all costs! Do not let it...
His words were cut off mid-sentence, as Gravis, or someone under his command, had the sense to flip over to an auxiliary communications channel. But Carrot knew words alone wouldn't be enough to justify killing Gravis to the Council. She needed him to make the first move. The unexpected switch from Republic targets to the Ascendant Spear threw the Imperial fleet into disarray. The interceptors swarming the Martyrus and the Hammerhead abandoned their strafing runs, peeling away to regroup for a coordinated assault on their new target. The destroyers disengaged from the Republic corvettes and thunderclaps, pulling back as they moved to position themselves between the Exemplar and Carrot's retaliation. The Republic fleet, unaware that they now shared a common enemy with their Imperial foes, seized the advantage. Seven interceptors were wiped out by the batteries of the Hammerhead and the Martyrus, and a steady stream of fire from the corvettes pummeled the retreating destroyers, overloading their deflector shields so that the incoming thunderclaps were able to inflict heavy damage. Carrot watched the sudden tactical shift with an intense hunger, instantly aware of the position and shield status of every vessel through the spear's advanced sensors. The information relayed directly through the pulsing wires of the command pod and into her cybernetic implants. Realizing the Republic vessels were focused on the suddenly vulnerable ships of Gravis's fleet, she sent the spear charging into the heart of the fray. Neither Gravis nor the Republic commander anticipated her strategy. Capital ships typically stayed at range, knowing their powerful guns could wear down smaller vessels from a safe distance. By moving into range of the fleets, Carrot was taking a risk. If they coordinated their efforts, they could overwhelm the spear. But Carrot knew the element of surprise would prevent that from happening. And at close proximity, the spear's turbo lasers could rip through deflectors and obliterate any of the other vessels in seconds. She started with the Martyrus.
As the spear bore down on the Republic ship, the battle descended into chaos. One of the corvettes and two of the thunderclaps altered course to try to save their flagship. The rest continued their assault on the crippled destroyers. 8 interceptors swooped back to try to save the destroyers. The rest hurtled toward the spear. The hammerhead closed on the exemplar as it tried to flee to the farthest edge of the conflict. The Martyrus tried to ward off the ascendant spear, but before it could bring its guns to bear, Carid opened fire with her entire forward-facing battery. Turbo lasers and ion cannons roared, combining in a glorious symphony of destruction, all but vaporizing the Martyrus in a matter of seconds. Carid relished the kill, sensing the terror of the dying crew through the Force. An instant later, she felt a sharp sliver of pain slicing through her, like someone had slid a vibroblade between her shoulders. Gravis had taken the bait, ordering the exemplar to fire on the spear. The blast penetrated the deflector shields and scorched the exterior hull, damage to the ship registering in Carid's mind like a wound to her own body. The exemplar was too far away to do any serious harm, but by firing the first shot, Gravis had given Carid the justification she needed to target his ships without having to answer to the Dark Council for destroying an Imperial fleet. The fighters that had tried to come to Martyrus' aid swooped by the spear, their strafing run sending 1,000 pinpricks up Carid's arms. She snuffed them out before they could make a second run. The hammerhead had caught the exemplar, forcing Gravis to focus on the immediate threat and preventing him from firing a second shot at the spear. One of the damaged destroyers had been finished off by the corvettes, which were now being hard-pressed by a phalanx of interceptors. The second interceptor squad was closing in on the spear. Carid opened fire with her turbo lasers, but only managed to hit 2 of them as the rest continued in undeterred. Carid's fingers flickered and danced on the control panel, and the spear banked at an impossible angle, directly into the path of the incoming horde. The spear had the maneuverability of a vessel half its size, and the unexpected change in direction happened too quickly for the interceptors to react. The tiny fighters were smashed to smithereens against the gargantuan battleship's hull. The move also brought the front of the spear in line with the surviving destroyers and interceptors still locked in battle with the corvettes. Carid's eyes flickered over the screens of the pod as she descended on the skirmish, the massive capital ship dwarfing the other players. She tapped the control panel, her fingers a blur, as she selected her targets in rapid succession. The interceptors, too engaged with the Republic vessels to take evasive action, were wiped out in the first volley. The corvettes were next, their deflectors useless against the spear's point-blank assault. The destroyers, already heavily damaged, were a mere afterthought. Several of the vessels were engulfed by fiery explosions, others rendered lifeless hunks of scrap, their hulls perforated with countless gaping holes. But Kara didn't have time to relish the carnage as she turned her attention to her final goal. The remaining hammerhead was still firing at the exemplar. Locked in close combat with the Republic ship, Gravis had been unable to prepare his vessel for the jump to hyperspace. Lowering the shields to make the jump wasn't an option when an enemy was firing at you. There had been a brief window for them both to escape while the spear was wiping out the other ships, but the Republic commander had failed to fully grasp the situation. Instead of mutual flight, he had chosen to continue the battle rather than risk an attempted retreat that would leave him vulnerable to the exemplar. Now it was too late for both of them. The ascendant spear closed rapidly on the 2 remaining ships. Concentrating her turbo lasers on the hammerhead's center, she sliced it cleanly in 2. Bodies and debris spilled out from the gutted Republic ship into the cold, dark void of space. At the same time, she sensed a massive energy signature emanating from the exemplar. Gravis was trying to make a last desperate jump to hyperspace. He dropped his shields and left his ship vulnerable to attack. But he knew he had no hope of defeating the Empire's most feared weapon if he stayed to fight. Drawing on the automated targeting systems of the spear, Carid fired a precision strike to disable the exemplar's hyperdrive, leaving Gravis at her mercy. A sudden beeping in her ear told her Gravis was trying to open a hailing channel.
but she had no interest in listening to him barter and beg for his life. Instead, she took aim and fired for the last time. The unshielded exemplar exploded into a ball of spectacular blue flame, instantly killing everyone aboard. Kerrod sent the spear into a long, slow circle, scanning the wreckage and debris of the entire battle for signs of life, but finding nothing. Satisfied, she contacted the bridge.
Moff Lorman, prepare to resume command.
Yes, my lord.
Kerrod tapped the controls beneath her fingers once more, severing her connection with the spear. She shuddered as the wires retracted, the needles of the biosynthetic interfaces slowly withdrawing her cybernetic implants. A wave of exhaustion washed over her, along with an overwhelming sense of intense and irreplaceable loss. Each time she broke her connection with the ship, it felt like losing a limb. The crystal sphere slowly opened to reveal her two apprentices still sitting cross-legged on the floor on either side. Their faces were drawn and haggard, their brows covered with sheens of sweat from supporting their master's exertion. But though they shared her fatigue, only she knew the glory of becoming one with the spear. And only she could understand the emptiness that enveloped her when the connection was broken.
Tell Moff Lorman to transmit the record of the battle to the Dark Council. Let them see that Gravas was a traitor to the Empire.
To herself, she added.
And let them see what happens to those who get in my way.
Chapter 9. The analytics office was a windowless, overcrowded room packed with computer terminals and 23 SIS agents, gathering, organizing, and analyzing data from the thousands of reports that came in every day. For the past week, the cramped office might as well have been Theron's home, as he and the rest of the understaffed team worked double shifts to try to stay on top of everything coming in. However, despite making a sincere effort to contribute, he couldn't shake the feeling that he was wasting his time. It wasn't that he didn't believe in what analytics was doing. He understood they were a vital component of SIS. But Theron had developed a unique set of specialized skills, almost none of which were applicable to his current position. It made him want to scream. 20 times a day, a piece of small but unusual information that begged further attention would pass across his desk, a potential lead to what might possibly be a mission critical to the safety of the Republic. Instead of being able to act on these leads, he had to write up reports with recommendations on how to proceed, then forward them to his superiors for review, knowing full well that by the time a field agent was assigned to the case, the opportunity would probably be lost. And even when he wasn't in the office, he was still stuck on Coruscant, probably the safest and most secure planet in the Republic, and the absolute last place Theron wanted to be. He feared that he was losing his edge. The day after day of boring desk work had dulled his survival instincts. The director had sentenced him to 3 months in this prison, and if he served his full time, he might never regain them. If he didn't get out of analytics soon, something bad was bound to happen. Maybe he'd resign in disgust, go rogue and take off on a mission without SIS approval or support. Or maybe he'd just snap and go on a rampage throughout the analytics office, smashing every monitor and computer station he could before the authorities dragged him away. Or, most terrifying of all, maybe he'd just learn to accept the drudgery of his new post. The only thing that had kept him sane so far was the few hours each day he was able to work on Operation Endgame, Jace Malcolm's special project. The Ascendant Spear was the last vestige of Darth Mekkis's superweapons research program, one last loose thread from the mission that had cost Negani Zhou his life. Theron had no problem spending his time trying to devise a plan to bring the spear down.
What bothered him was the thought that some other agent would be the one to actually put that plan into effect. He felt a tap on his shoulder as the voice of his supervisor said,
"Time to pack it in, Theron."
Surprised, Theron glanced at the chrono on the wall.
"Guess I lost track of time," he said. "Another sign you're losing your edge. The days used to drag on forever. You could feel each individual agonizing second slipping by. Now you're getting so used to being stuck in the chair, you don't even notice when it's time to leave. You're numb."
"Go home and get some sleep,"
his supervisor ordered.
"The reports will still be here tomorrow."
"Is that supposed to make me feel better?"
Theron silently wondered as he stood up and headed back to his apartment. Once inside, he briefly considered doing some off-the-clock work on Operation Endgame. Even from home, he had access to files with all but the highest level of security clearance. But the drudgery of analytics sapped both his physical and mental energy. All he wanted to do was collapse into bed.
"They're grinding you down bit by bit."
Ignoring the voice inside his head, Theron made his way to the bedroom at the rear of the apartment, stripped off his clothes, flicked off the light, and crawled under the covers. Just as he was on the verge of drifting off, however, he was jarred awake by the chime of an incoming holocall.
"I accept incoming,"
he muttered groggily, taking a moment to realize the call wasn't coming on his cybernetic implant. He rolled over and tapped the holocall on the nightstand beside the bed, propping himself up on his elbow to get a better view. To his surprise, an image of Tefith materialized before him, the glow of the holo spreading faintly across the otherwise darkened room.
"Why are you in bed?"
the Twi'lek asked, arching her eyebrows in surprise.
"You sleeping? Or you with a friend?"
I'm alone,"
Theron stammered, his mind spinning as he tried to wrap his head around the situation.
"Why is she calling? Where is she calling from? How did she know where I'm staying?"
"Didn't think you'd be home. Gonna leave a message."
Theron realized he wasn't the only one taken aback by their unexpected conversation. Knowing Tefith was a bit flustered as well helped him regain some of his composure.
"So give me the message."
After a moment's hesitation, Tefith took a deep breath, then blurted out,
"Know you are there on Nar Shaddaa. Don't need you following us. Don't want you following us. Back off, or you'll be sorry."
"How'd you even get this number?"
Theron asked, not bothering to respond to her ultimatum.
"Not so hard. You think you're only one who can find people?"
"So you went to all the trouble of tracking me down just to tell me to leave you alone?"
"Didn't ask for your help. Don't need it. Take care of ourselves."
"Really? Seemed to me if I hadn't stepped in, you'd be a rotting corpse in a Nar Shaddaa landfill right about now."
"Think we owe you now? That's why you help us?"
"I just happened to be in the area. Thought I'd help you out for old time's sake."
"Liar. Not just Nar Shaddaa, right? You there on Korriban? Belsavis? Zyost?"
"I've never been to Zyost in my life."
"No more watching. Stop following us. Got it?"
"Don't worry about it. I'm staying on Coruscant for a while. Taking some time off from field work. I'm focusing on reports and paperwork now."
Why would you even tell her that? You becoming one of those office drones that complains to anyone who will listen?
"You? Behind a desk?"
Tefith's face broke into a grin.
"Funny."
"The choice wasn't really mine,"
Theron said, his voice betraying more anger than he intended.
"Always got a choice. Sounds like you just a quitter."
"Why do you even care?"
"Don't,"
Tefith said with a shrug.
"Be boring. We don't care. Just leave us alone."
The holo abruptly disconnected, leaving Theron alone in the dark. He rolled over, closed his eyes, and tried to go to sleep. But something Tefith had said had lodged itself inside his head, and instead of drifting off into dreamland, he kept circling back to it.
"She mentioned Zyost. The old Tian Brotherhood must have begun moving in there when the Empire started allowing outsiders to visit the world."
The simple fact might seem insignificant,
But Theron knew there was a reason he couldn't let it go. His subconscious had latched onto it for some reason. Now he had to draw it out.
Zyost. That's the key! Zyost!
In a flash of inspiration, it all came together. Operation Endgame. Ignited by the catalyst, the past week of research and analysis fused into the beginnings of a plan to bring down the Ascendant Spear. Theron sprang out of bed, eager to record the details while they were still fresh in his mind.
And, with a little luck, this will get me back in the field, too.
Darth Maar was the last of the assembled Dark Council members to arrive at their secret chamber beneath the Citadel. He'd scheduled the meeting, contacting the others only hours after learning of Darth Grievous's death. But even though he'd summoned them, he still had no idea what he was going to say. He'd reviewed the official records of the battle over Lerator, including transcriptions of the communications between Grievous and Carrot in the field reports filed by Moff Lorman. The Ascendant Spear dropped out of hyperspace beyond range of the Republic scanners, at which time Darth Carrot informed Darth Grievous of our arrival.
Darth Grievous, this is Darth Carrot. The Ascendant Spear is at your disposal.
Disengage, Carrot. We didn't call for reinforcements. This is my battle to win, not yours.
Darth Carrot disregarded Darth Grievous's request, choosing to aid the Imperial war effort by engaging the enemy fleet. After the Ascendant Spear disposed of one of the Republic hammerheads, Darth Grievous and Darth Carrot had the following exchange.
You think this will turn the Dark Council against me, Carrot? You could take out every Republic ship in this quadrant. But when it comes time to choose someone to join their ranks, they'll still pick me over a Fallen.
You do not grasp the danger you are in, Grievous. You could be killed in this battle. I am here to ensure a desirable outcome for the Empire.
Ignore the Republic ships! Fire on the Ascended Spear! Destroy it at all costs! Do not let it!
At this time, Grievous switched to an auxiliary communications channel. Shortly after this, he fired on the Ascendant Spear as we continued to engage the Republic fleet. Darth Carrot was forced to destroy Grievous and his fleet to defend her ship and crew. The official military review would clearly show Grievous had been in the wrong. However, it was obvious to Maar, just as it would be obvious to everyone on the Dark Council, that Carrot had intentionally goaded him into firing the first shot. The fact that Carrot had brazenly defied Maar's instructions and undermined his attempts to unify the Sith by eliminating a rival was disturbing. He was starting to wonder if granting her a seat on the Dark Council would be more trouble than it was worth. His immediate concern, however, was dealing with the fallout from the other Sith lords assembled in the room.
Darth Maar,
Vauron said by way of greeting.
It's impolite to keep us all waiting.
Maar ignored the Sith's sardonic words.
You all know what happened to Grievous,
he said, getting straight to the matter at hand.
You all know why we're here.
It seems Grievous is no longer a viable candidate,
Vauron said with a coy smile.
Does this mean Carrot is our choice by default?
That question must be answered by the entire Dark Council,
Maar replied, bracing himself for the outrage and protests of the others. There was an unexpected silence before the ancient Darth Rictus spoke up.
Carrot answered the question for us,
he proclaimed.
She bested her rival with strength, yet was cunning enough to make it appear she was in the right. These are the traits of a true Sith.
Darth Maar was left momentarily speechless at the unexpected show of support. Given Rictus's many years on the Dark Council, his approval would go a long way toward winning the others over.
We were willing to give the seat to Grievous if he defeated the Republic at Lerator,
Mortis chimed in.
Since Carrot claimed the victory, she deserves the prize.
Maar was even more surprised by Mortis's support. His sphere of influence was laws and justice. And even though the Empire's version of justice could often be summarized as might makes right,
He'd assume Mortis would be outraged by what Carrot had done.
Gravis was your candidate,
he said, looking for clarification.
You don't want to seek revenge for his death?
I thought Gravis was more powerful than Carrot,
he replied.
But his death proves otherwise. She issued a challenge, and he accepted by firing on her ship. A fatal mistake. It seems I underestimated the Falling.
She took bold action,
Darth Ravage added.
She saw what she wanted, and she seized it. If more of the other Sith Lords beneath us followed her example, the Republic would not have us running like cowards.
Their words momentarily caught Mar by surprise. Though Carrot's actions were perfectly in line with the traditional ways of the Sith, he thought it would take longer for the rest of the Dark Council to overcome their inherent prejudice and welcome a member of a lesser species into their ranks. However, he understood that their willingness to embrace Carrot was still driven by the one trait they all shared: self-preservation. As Dark Lords of the Sith, they understood the power of Carrot's ship and the opportunity she represented. The spear was vital if they hoped to turn the tide of the Galactic War. And down the road, Carrot could be a powerful ally to use against not only the Republic, but also the other members of the Dark Council. For now, they would invite her in with open arms, each publicly voicing support to try to win her over as they bided their time. Waiting patiently, they would play their political games, trying to twist her allegiance so they could use her and her ship to their own advantage, even as they slowly plotted her destruction. In other words, they would see her as they each saw every other member of the Dark Council, simultaneously a potential ally and a potential enemy. Mar sighed inwardly. Carrot had not hesitated to wipe out a fellow Dark Lord to advance her own career, even though the loss of Gravis made the Empire more vulnerable to the Republic. He had hoped the Falling might be more open to his efforts to unify the Sith against a common foe, but she had proven herself to be as much a student of the old ways as all the others. Despite his best efforts, the culture of backstabbing and infighting still prevailed. The Emperor had kept it under control by virtue of his own unassailable position and power. But in his absence, it was eating away at the core of the Empire. And Mar was starting to doubt if he, or any among the great Sith Lords, would be able to stop it. Chapter 10 Marcus moved quickly through the halls of Coruscant's massive Senate building, heading for Jace Malcolm's office in the military wing. 40 standard years ago, the senators would have been horrified if a military officer, even the supreme commander of all Republic forces, had an office in the same building. Back then, most politicians had openly called for a massive decrease in the size of the Republic fleet and a reduction in the number of soldiers. The idea of a full-scale galactic war seemed preposterous, and the desire to shrink the scope and budget of the armed forces was virtually unanimous. 4 decades of war against the re-emerged Sith Empire had changed things significantly. When the Treaty of Coruscant had been forced on the Republic years ago, some believed a lasting peace with the Empire was possible. But in the last 18 months, the uneasy truce had collapsed, and a return to full-scale hostilities silenced all talk of peace in the halls of the Senate. As the tide of war shifted to the Republic's favor, the idea of ending the Imperial threat once and for all began to gain support. The Republic's growing military resolve was championed by the newly elected Chancellor Suresh. The former governor of Terras, few had seen her as a candidate for the Republic's highest political position, but she swept to power on a wave of aggressive anti-Imperial sentiment. Unlike others vying to succeed Chancellor Janaris, she hadn't promised to bring the Republic peace. She promised victory. Within days of her election, she enacted all 36 wartime provisions listed in the Galactic Constitution, greatly expanding the powers and responsibilities of her office and allowing her to make major political appointments without Senate approval. There had been some behind-the-scenes grumbling at the sudden increase in executive power,
but Suresh quickly quieted the dissenters by appointing the wildly popular Jace Malcolm as the new Supreme Commander. The director had studied Suresh's rapid rise to power carefully. It was impossible not to be impressed by her ambition and her political brilliance. Tapping Jace for Supreme Commander had been a particularly astute move. Nobody would speak out against such a long-serving Republic hero. His selection legitimized every appointment that came after. Suresh had found the perfect candidate to solidify her support, and she'd put the military under the charge of a man who was as eager to wipe out the Republic's imperial foes as she was. Not that the director minded. He also believed crushing the Empire was key to securing the Republic, and he was ready to show how valuable SIS would be to that cause. Operation Transom hadn't ended as planned. Operation Endgame was his chance to make up for it. As he approached Jace's office, Marcus allowed himself a hint of a smile. They'd presented the Supreme Commander with a basic outline of Operation Endgame just yesterday, and Jace had already scheduled a meeting to discuss it in more detail. Clearly, he'd been impressed. The director was more than a little impressed himself. The analytics team had gone above and beyond for this project. They'd managed to pull everything together in just over a week, thanks largely to Theron's contributions. Marcus had been worried about Theron's potentially disruptive impact when he'd assigned him to the team, though he'd hoped the nature of their research might make the transition from fieldwork easier. Much to the director's relief, as soon as Theron realized analytics was working on a way to put an end to Darth Mekkis's legacy once and for all, he'd thrown himself into the work.
"Maybe he's maturing," Marcus thought.
The director wasn't normally an optimistic man, but he couldn't help but wonder if things were looking up. If Theron learned to stay out of trouble, and Jace could secure SIS's future long-term funding, maybe he wouldn't wake up every morning with a crippling migraine.
"Welcome back, Director,"
the receptionist greeted him, her features breaking into a smile.
"Did you miss me?"
he asked, responding with a grin of his own.
"I count every second of every day that you're not here,"
she replied, even as she buzzed him in. As before, Jace Malcolm was sitting behind his desk when the director entered his office.
"I've already started pulling together the resources you requested for Operation Endgame,"
the Supreme Commander told him, jumping right to the point.
"You'll have everything you need."
"I'll pass your appreciation on to the analytics team," Marcus replied. "They were pulling double shifts all week to get this done. The overtime took a big chunk out of our budget, but we figured this was worth it."
"I could take a hint,"
Jace said with a smile, indicating for the director to take a seat in the chair across from him.
"I'll make sure your department gets all the credits you need going forward."
Marcus